were about to follow the faithful departed to an untimely grave, face frozen beneath her alabaster base paint, black skull paint slipping with sweat. "My son! My son!" she cried out, shrill and cracked. "My firstborn sweet! His father's endowment! My only joy!" "Sister Glorica, please," said Hero, looking bored. Ortis's mother had wrapped both arms around him now and was weeping fully into his shoulder. Her own shook with very real fear and grief. He looked wetly depressed. She was saying between sobs, "I gave you my husband, Lord Nonius Fianus. I gave you my spouse, Lord Nonius Fianus. Do you demand my son of me? Do you demand my son? Surely not! Surely not now!"
"You forget yourself, Glorica," Crux snapped.
"I know the things that befall cavaliers, my lord. I know his fate."
"Sister Glorica," Hero Hark said, "be calm."
"He is young,"
quavered Ortis's mother, half pulling him into the safety of the chevet when she realized Lord Nonius Vianus would not intercede.
"He is young. He is not robust."
"Some would say otherwise," said Hero Hark, sotto voce.
But Ortis said, with his big, somber eyes and his squashed, disheartened voice,
"I do fear death, my lady Harrow Hark."
"A cavalier should welcome death," said Aiglamine, affronted.
"Your father welcomed death unflinching," said Crux.
At this tender piece of sympathy, his mother burst into tears. The congregation muttered, mostly reproachful, and Gideon started to perk up. It wasn't quite the worst day of her life now. This was some A-grade entertainment. Ortis, not bothering to disentangle himself from his sobbing parent, was mumbling that he would make sure she was provided for. The heinous great-aunts had returned to prayer and were crooning a wordless hymn. Crux was loudly abusing Ortis's mother, and Herohark stood in this sea, mute and contemptuous as a monument.
"Leave and pray for guidance, or I'll have you. I'll take you off the sanctuary," Crux was saying.
"I gave this house everything. I paid the highest price."
"What comes of Mortis marrying an immigrant eighth, you shameful hag?"
Gideon was grinning so hugely that her split lips recommenced bleeding. Amid the massed heads of the uncaring dead and the disturbed devout, Hero Hark's eyes found hers, and that disdainful mask slipped in its blankness. Her lips thinned. The people clamoured. Gideon winked.
"Enough!" snapped the reverend daughter, voice like a knife's edge. "Let us pray!"
Silence sank over the congregation, like the slowly falling flakes of luminescent dust. The sobbing of Ortis's mother hushed into silent, shuddering tears, buried in her son's chest as he put his doughy arm around her. He was crying soundlessly into her hair. The hymn of the nasty great-aunts ended on a high and tremulous note, never relieved, wasting away in mid-air. Hero bowed her head, and her parents did too, simultaneous in obedience. The great-aunts nodded their heads to their chests. Aiglamine and Crux followed suit. Gideon stared up at the ceiling and recrossed her ankles over each other, blinked bits of luminescent grit from her eyes.
"I pray the tomb is shut forever," recited Hero Hark, with the curious fervidity she always showed in prayer. "I pray the rock is never rolled away. I pray that which was buried remains buried, insensate in perpetual rest, with closed eye and stilled brain. I pray it lives. I pray it sleeps. I pray for the needs of the Emperor All-Giving, the Undying King, his virtues and his men. I pray for the second house, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, seventh, and eighth. I pray for the ninth house, and I pray for it to be fruitful. I pray for the soldiers and adepts far from home, and all those parts of the empire that live in unrest and disquiet. Let it be so.
They all prayed to let it be so, with much rattling of bones. Gideon had not prayed for a very long time. She looked over the bald, gleaming skulls of the assembled skeletons and the short-haired heads of the faithful ninth, and wondered what she'd do first when she left for Trentum. The sobs of Ortis's unfortunate mother interrupted the clatter and her less-than-realistic thoughts of doing chin-ups in front of a dozen clapping ensigns, and she saw Hero whispering to Crux, gesturing at mother and son, her face a painting of bloodless patience. Crux led them off the sanctuary none too gently. They passed down the centre of the nave, Crux hustling, Ortis lumbering, Ortis's mother barely able to stand in her misery. Gideon gave the unfortunate cavalier a thumbs up as they passed. Ortis returned a brief and watery smile. Muster broke up after that. Most of the congregation stayed to keep praying at their good fortune, knowing that the second Arius bell would be ringing in a scant hour anyway. Gideon would have vaulted up to leave and sprint back to her shuttle first thing, but the skeletons flooded out in neat, serried ranks down the centre of the nave, two abreast, blocking all other progress in their readiness to get back to their snow leaks and the heat lamps of their fields. The disgusting great-aunts removed themselves behind the parcloses to the claustrophobic family chapel off to one side, and Herohark ordered her parents' complacent mummies out of sight to wherever she usually hid them, back in their lavish household cell probably, and to bar the door after. Gideon was massaging sprains from her fingers as her swordmaster came seesawing down the aisle. "She lies," said Gideon absently, by way of greeting. "If you hadn't noticed, she never keeps her promises, not a one." Iglamine did not answer. Gideon didn't expect her to. She just stood there, not yet meeting her student's gaze, one liver-spotted hand clutched tight to the grip of her sword. Eventually she said gruffly, "You have always suffered from a want of duty, Nav. You can't argue that. You couldn't spell obligation if I shoved the letters up your ass." "I gotta say, I don't think that would help," said Gideon. "God, I'm glad you didn't teach me my spelling." "A soldier's best quality is her sense of allegiance, of loyalty. Nothing else survives." "I know," said Gideon, and, experimenting, rose from the pew. She was standing fine, but her ribs ached. One was probably cracked. Her butt hurt from being dragged. She was going to be swollen with bruises before nightfall, and she needed to have a tooth put back in. Not by one of the nuns, though. Never again. The cohort would have bone magicians aplenty. "I know, it's fine. Don't get me wrong, Captain. Where I'm going, I promise to piss fidelity all the livelong day. I have lots of fealty in me. I fealt the Emperor with every bone in my body. I fealt hard." "You wouldn't know fealty if it..." "Don't hypothetically shove stuff up my butt again," said Gideon. "It never does any good." The lopsided old woman took a scabbard off her back and wearily handed it over. It was Gideon's. Her sword had been sheathed safely inside it. Aglamine tossed her the abandoned suitcase to boot. This would be the closest to an apology she would get. The woman would never touch her, and she would never give her a word that had no edges. But this was nearly tender for the captain of the guard, and Gideon would take it and run. Determined footsteps sounded down the centre aisle, alongside the sound of ancient lace rustling over slick obsidian. Gideon's gut tightened, but she said, "How the hell are you going to get out of this one, Nona Jesimus?" "I'm not," said Hero, surprising her. The reverend daughter's sharp-angled, foxy chin was thrust out, and she still had a thick rime of blood circling each nostril, but with her burning black eyes she looked exalted as a bad bone saint.
I'm going. This is my chance for intercession. You couldn't comprehend.
I can't, but I also couldn't care less, said Gideon.
We all get our chances, Nav. You got yours.
Gideon wanted to punch her lights out, but she said instead with forced jollity,
By the way, I worked out your nasty little trick, jackass.
Iglamine did not cuff her for this, which was also some sort of apology. She just jabbed a warning finger in her direction. Hero cocked her chin up in genuine surprise, hood falling away from her dark, short-cropped head.
Did you? She drawled. Really?
Your mother's signature on the commission. The sting in the tail. If I come clean, she said, that renders the signature null and void, doesn't it? It buys my silence. Well played. I'll have to keep my mouth shut when I hand that one over, and you know it.
Hero Hark cocked her head the other way, lightly.
I hadn't even thought of that, she said. I thought you meant the shuttle.
Alarm bells rang in Gideon's head, like the first and second peal all mixed together. She could feel the heat drain from her face, and she was already backing out of the pew into the aisle, wheeling away. Hero Hark's face was a painted study of innocence, of perfect unconcern. At the expression on Gideon's, Iglamine had put a hand on her sword, moving herself between the two with a warning stump of the leg. Gideon said with difficulty,
What about the shuttle?
Oh, Autus and his mother stole it, said Hero Hark. They must be gone already. She still has family back on the 8th, and she thinks they'll take them in.
At her expression, Hero laughed.
You make it so easy, Griddle. You always do.
Gideon had never confronted a broken heart before. She had never gotten far enough to have her heart broken. She knelt on the landing field, knees in the grit, arms clutched around herself. There was nothing left but blown-out curly patterns in the pebbles where the shuttle had passed. A great dullness had sunk over her, a deep coldness, a thick stolidity. When her heart beat in her chest, it was with a huge, steady grief. Every pulse seemed to be the space between insensibility and knives. For some moments, she was awake, and she was filled with a slow-burning mine fire, the kind that never went out and crumbled everything from the inside. For all the other moments, it was as though she had gone somewhere else. Behind her stood the lady of the 9th house, watching her with no satisfaction.
I got wind of your plan only last week, she admitted.
Gideon said nothing.
A week before, Harrow continued, I wouldn't have known at all if I hadn't got the summons. You'd done everything right. They said I could put my reply on the shuttle I had previously scheduled if I wanted to write in paper. I will give you your due. There was no way you could have accounted for that. I could have spoiled it before, but I wanted to wait until now to do anything. I wanted to wait for the very moment when you thought you'd gotten away, to take it from you. Gideon could only manage.
Why? The girl's expression was the same as it was on the day that Gideon had found her parents dangling from the roof of their cell. It was blank and white and still.
Because I completely fucking hate you, said Hero Hark. No offence.
Chapter 4
It would have been neater, perhaps, if all of Gideon's disappointments and woes from birth downward had used that moment as a catalyst. If, filled with a new and fiery determination, she had equipped herself down there in the dark with fresh ambition to become free. She didn't. She got the depression. She lay in her cell, picking at life like it was a meal she didn't want to eat. She didn't touch her sword. She didn't go and jog around the planter fields and dream of what days looked like to cohort recruits. She stole a crate of the nutrient paste they put in the gruels and soups fed to the Ninth Faithful and squirted them in her mouth when she got hungry, listlessly leafing through magazines or lying back on her bed, crunching her body into sit-ups to make time go away. Crux had snapped the security cuff back on her ankle, and she rattled it when she moved, often not bothering to turn on the lights, clinking around in the dark. A week's grace was all she got. The Reverend daughter turned up, as she always goddamn did, standing outside the locked door of her cell. Gideon knew she was there because the shadows in front of the little peephole changed, and because it would be nobody else. By way of hello, she said, "Fuck you," and switched to push-ups. "Stop sulking, Griddle. Go choke on a dick." "I have work for you," said Harrowhark. Gideon let herself rest on the apex extension of her arms, staring down sightlessly at the cold floor, the sweat frosting on her back. Her ribs still hurt when she breathed, and the cuff was heavy on her ankle, and one of the nuns had jammed her tooth back in too hard, and it was like the woe of the Emperor every time she sneezed. "Nona Jessimus," she said slowly, "the only job I'd do for you would be if you wanted someone to hold the sword as you fell on it. The only job I'd do for you would be if you wanted your ass kicked so hard the locked tomb opened and a parade came out to sing, 'Lo, a destructed ass!' The only job I'd do would be if you wanted me to spot you while you backflipped off the top tier into Dreaber." "That's three jobs," said Harrowhark. "Die in a fire, Nona Jessimus!" There was a rustle from outside, the light scrape of a pin being pulled from a stud before it was pushed through the mesh of the peephole. Belatedly, Gideon scrambled up to toss it back, as one did a grenade. But the bead of Harrow's earring had landed in her cell, and from that tiny mote of bone sprung humerus, radius, and ulna. A skeletal hand groped blindly at the key in the lock and turned it even as Gideon swung her boot around to smash it into splintery bits. It crumbled away to dust, including the stud. Harrowhark, Nona Jessimus, swung open the door, haloed faintly in the electric lights from the tier, her acerbic little face as welcome as a knee to the groin. "If you want to do something interesting, come with me," she commanded. "If you want to wallow in your shockingly vast reserves of self-pity, cut your throat and save me the food bill." "Oh, damn, then can I join your old man and lady in the puppet show?" "How the world would suffer without your wit," said Harrowhark blandly. "Get your robe. We're going down to the catacomb." It was almost gratifying, Gideon reflected, struggling with the black folds of her church gown, that the heir to the House of the Ninth refused to walk with her on the inside of the tier. She walked close to the wall instead, keeping pace half a step behind Gideon, watching for Gideon's hands and Gideon's sword. Almost gratifying, but not quite. Hero could make even overweening caution offensive. After long days with just her little reading lamp, Gideon's eyes stung from the lukewarm light of the ninth drill shaft. She blinked myopically as the lift rattled them down to the doors of Dreaber. "We're not going into the inner sanctuary, you recreant," Harrow said as Gideon balked. "We're going to the monument. Come!" The lifts that went down into the fetid bowels of Dreaber were death traps. The ones they entered now, down to the crypts, were especially bad. This one was an open platform of oxygen-addled, creaking metal, tucked behind an iron door that Hero opened with a tiny chip key from around her neck. As they descended, the air that rushed up to meet them was so cold that it made Gideon's eyes water. She pulled the hood of her cloak down over her head and shoved her hands up its sleeves. The central buried mechanism that made their pit on this planet possible sang its low, whining song, filling the elevator shaft, dying away as they went deeper and deeper into the rock. It was profoundly dark.
Stark, strong lights swamped their landing, and they walked out into the labyrinth of cages filled with whirring generators that nobody knew how to work. The machines sat alone in their carved-out, chilly niches, garlanded with black crepe from ninth devotees long dead, their barred housings keeping the two at arm's length as they passed. The cave narrowed into a passageway, and the passageway terminated in a pitted door. Hero pushed this open and led the way into a long, oblong chamber of bone-choked niches and bad copies of funerary masks, of wrapped bundles and seriously ancient grave goods. At one niche, Aglamine kneeled, having set herself the task of ransacking as many of the wrapped bundles as she could. Instead of a ninth robe, she wore a thick wool jacket and gloves, which gave her the appearance of a marshmallow pierced with four toothpicks of differing lengths. She was wearing a particularly po-faced battle-weary expression as she picked through around 100 swords in varying stages of death. Next to her was a basket of daggers and a handful of knuckle knives. Some were rusted to hell. Some were halfway rusted to hell. She was examining a sword and gloomily rubbing at a bit of built-up plaque on the blade. "This plan is doomed," she said to them without looking up.
"Success, Captain," said Harrowhark.
"They're all archaeology, my lady."
"Unfortunate. What was Ortiz preferring these days?"
"Speaking freely," said Aglamine, "Ortiz preferred his mother and a book of sad poems. His father trained him to fight sword and buckler, but after his death..." She gave a somewhat creaking shrug. "He was a damned poor swordsman at his peak. He was not his father's son. I would have trained him sword and powder, but he said he had the catarrh."
"But his sword must be good, surely?"
"God no," said Aglamine. "It was heavy oil amalgam, and it had a rubber tip, lighter than Nav's head."
"Harsh," said Gideon.
"No, lady. I'm looking for a blade in the style of his great-grandmother's, and a knife or a knuckle."
"Powder," said Harrowhark decidedly, "or chain."
"A knife, I think, my lady," her captain said again, with more gentle deference than Gideon had known the old woman possessed. "Knife or knuckle. The knife will be impossibly difficult to adjust to as it is. You fight in a crowd. A chain in close melee will be more of a danger to you than it will to anyone else."
Gideon had long since decided that this was not a good place to be, and that the plans being hatched here were not plans she liked. She started to edge backward toward the door, picking her path as lightly as possible.
Suddenly, there was Hera, squeezing herself between two pillars and draping her arms above her head. Long folds of black robe shook down from her arms, making her look like a road-blocking bat.
"Oh, Nav, no," she said calmly. "Not when you owe me."
"Owe you?"
"Why, of course," said Harrowhark. "It was your shuttle my cavalier ran off in."
Gideon's fist jacked out toward Harrow's pointy nose. Less by design than accident, the other girl stumbled out of the way, half tripping, dusting herself off and narrowing her eyes as she circled around the pillar.
"If you're going to start that again," she said, "here."
She reached down and hauled up one of the discarded blades. It was at least mildly hilarious to see Hero have to heave with all the might of her, like, three muscles. Gideon took it while the necromancer rubbed fretfully at her wrists.
"Try that," she said.
Gideon unsheathed and examined the sword. Long, black pieces of crooked metal formed a decaying basket hilt. A terrifically worn black pommel seal depicted the tomb wrapped in chains, the sign of the ninth. The blade itself was notched and cracked.
"Only way this kills someone is with lockjaw," she said. "How are you going to get Ortiz back, anyway?"
Did Hero look momentarily troubled?
"We're not."
"Aglamine's too old for this."
"And that is why you, Griddle," said the lady, "are to act as Cavalier Primary of the House of the Ninth. You will accompany me to the first house as I study to become a lictor. You'll be my personal guard and companion, dutiful and loyal, and uphold the sacred name of this house and its people."
Once Gideon had stopped laughing, leaning against the icy pillar and beating on it with her fist, she had to breathe long and hard in order to not crack up again. The beleaguered grimace on Iglamine's hard-carved face had deepened into an outright sense of siege.
"Whew!" she managed, scrubbing away tears of mirth. "Oh, damn! Give me a moment. Okay.
Like hell I will, Nona Jesimus!"
Hero ducked out from behind her pillar, and she walked toward Gideon, hands still clasped together. Her face held the beatific, fire-white expression she'd had the day she told Gideon she was going off-planet, an unwavering resolve, almost like joy. She stopped in front of the other girl and looked up at her, shaking the hood from her dark head, and she closed her eyes into slits.
"Come on, Nav," she said, and her voice was alight. "This is your chance. This is your opportunity to come into glory. Follow me through this, and you can go anywhere. House Cavaliers can get any cohort position they like. Do this for me, and I won't just set you free. I'll set you free with a fortune, with a commission, with anything you want." This nettled her.
"You don't own me."
"Oh, Griddle, but I do," said Hero Hark. "You're bound to the locked tomb, and at the end of the night, the locked tomb is me. The nominated hands are to enter the first house, Nav. Their names will be written in history as the new Imperial Saints. Nothing like this has ever happened before, and it may never happen again. Nav, I'm going to be a lictor."
"Hello, I'm the woman who helped Hero Hark Nona Jesimus's fascist rise to power," said Gideon to nobody in particular. "Yes, the universe sucks now. I knew this going in. Also, she betrayed me afterward, and now my body has been shot into the sun."
Hero came too close, and Gideon did what she had never done in the past. She raised the rusted sword so that its naked point was level with the other girl's forehead. The necromancer adept did not flinch, just made her black smeared mouth a mocking moo of shock.
"I will never trust you. Your promises mean nothing. You've got nothing to give me. I know what you'd do, given half a chance."
Hera's dark eyes were on Gideon's, past the blade pointed at her skull.
"Oh, I have hurt your heart," she said.
Gideon kept it absolutely level. "I boo-hooed for hours."
"It won't be the last time I make you weep."
Iglamine's voice rattled out.
"Put that damn thing down! I can't bear to see you hold it with that grip!"
And, shocking Gideon,
"Consider this offer, Nav!"
Gideon peered around Hero's shoulder, letting the blade drop, trashing the miserable thing scabbardless in the nearest niche.
"Captain, please don't be a proponent of this horseshit idea." "It's the best idea we have, Nav," said her teacher. "Our lady is going off planet. That's the long and short of it. You can stay here, in the house you hate, or go attain your liberty, in service to the house you hate. This is your one chance to leave, and to gain your freedom cleanly."
Hero Hark opened her mouth to say something, but surprising Gideon further, Iglamine silenced her with a gesture. The crappy swords were set aside with care, and the old woman pulled her bockety leg out from underneath her and leant the good one against the catacomb wall, pushing hard to stand with a clank of mail and bone disease.
"You care nothing for the ninth. That's fine. This is your chance to prove yourself."
"I'm not helping Nona Jesimus become a lictor. She'll make me into boots."
"I have condemned your escapes," said Iglamine. "They were graceless and feeble. But,"
she turned to the other girl,
"with all due respect, you've dealt her too ill, my lady. I hate this idea. If I were 10 years younger, I would beg you to condescend to take me. But you won't vouchsafe her, and so I must.
Must you? Said Hero.
There was a curious softness in her voice. Her black gaze was searching for something in the captain of her guard, and she did not seem to be finding it.
I must, said Aglamine. You'll be leaving me and Crux in charge of the house. If I vouchsafe the freedom of Gideon Nav, and it is not given to her, then, begging pardon for my ingratitude, it is a betrayal of myself, who is your retainer, and was your mother's retainer.
Harrowheart said nothing. She wore a thin, pensive expression.
Gideon wasn't fooled.
This look usually betokened Hera's brain percolating outrageous nastiness. But Gideon couldn't think straight. A horrible dark red heat was travelling up her neck, and she knew it would go right to her cheeks if she let it, so she pulled the hood up over her head and said not a word, and couldn't look at her swordmaster at all.
If she satisfies you, you must let her go, said Aglamine firmly.
Of course.
With all the gracious promises of the ninth.
Oh, if she pulls this off, she can have whatever she likes, said Harrowhark easily, way too easily. She'll have glory squirting out each orifice. She can do or be anything she pleases, preferably over on the other side of the galaxy from where I am.
Then I thank you for your mercy and your grace, and regard the matter settled, said Aglamine. How is it settled? I have patently not agreed to this shit.
Both of them ignored Gideon.
Getting back to the original problem, said the old woman, settling painfully back down among the swords and the knives. Nav has had none of Ortis's training, not in manners, nor in general scholarship, and she was trained in the sword of heavy infantry.
Ignore the first. Her mental inadequacies can be compensated for. The second's what I'm interested in. How difficult is it for a normal swordswoman to switch from a double-handed blade to a cavalier rapier?
For a normal swordswoman to reach the standard of a house cavalier primary, you'd need years. For Nav, 3 months.
Here, Gideon died briefly of gratification. She revived only due to the rising horror consequent of everything else.
And she'd be up to the standard of the meanest, most behindhand cavalier alive.
Oh, nonsense, said Hero languorously. She's a genius. With the proper motivation, Griddle could wield 2 swords in each hand and 1 in her mouth. While we were developing common sense, she studied the blade. Am I right, Griddle?
I haven't agreed to stone-cold dick, said Gideon, and I don't care how badass cavaliers are meant to be. I hate rapiers. All that bouncing around makes me feel tired. Now, a 2-hander, that's a swordsman's sword. I don't disagree, said her teacher, but a house cavalier, with all her proper training, is a handsomely dangerous thing. I saw the primary cavalier of the House of the Second fight in his youth, and my God, I never forgot it.
Hero was pacing in tiny circles now.
But she could get to the point where she might believably, possibly be mistaken for a trained cavalier of the House of the Ninth.
The reputation of the Ninth Cavalier Primary has not been what it was since the days of Matthias Nonius, said Aglamine, and that was 1,000 years ago. Expectations are very low. Even then, we'd be bloody lucky.
Gideon pushed herself up from the pillar and cracked her knuckles, stretching her chill-stiff muscles out before her. She rolled her neck, testing her shoulders, and unwrapped her robe from around herself.
I live for those days when everyone stands around talking about how bad I am at what I do.
But it also gives me hurt feelings, she said, and took the sword she had abandoned for trash.
She tested its weight in her hand, feeling what was to her an absurd lightness, and struck what she thought was a sensible stance.
How's this, Captain?
Her teacher made a noise in her throat somewhere between disgust and desolation.
"What are you doing with your other hand?" Gideon compensated. "No, oh Lord, put that down until I formally show you how."
"The sword and the powder," said Harrowhark eagerly.
"The sword and the knuckle, my lady," said Iglamine. "I'm dropping my expectations substantially."
Gideon said, "I still have absolutely not agreed to any of this."
The Reverend Daughter picked her way toward her over discarded swords and stopped once she was level with the pillar that Gideon had reflexively flattened her back against. They regarded each other for long moments until the absolute chill of the monument made Gideon's teeth involuntarily chatter, and then Hera's mouth twisted fleetingly, indulgently.
"I would have thought you would be happy that I needed you," she admitted, "that I showed you my girlish and vulnerable heart."
"Your heart is a party for 5,000 nails," said Gideon.
"That's not a no. Help Iglamine find you a sword, Griddle. I'll leave the door unlocked."
With that languid and imperious command, she left, leaving Gideon lolling her head back against the frigid stone of the pillar and chewing the inside of her cheek. It was almost worse getting left alone with the swordmaster. An awkward, chilly silence spread between them as the old woman grumpily picked through the pile, holding each rapier up to the light, pulling rancid strips of leather away from the grip.
"It's a bad idea, but it's a chance, you know," said Iglamine abruptly. "Take it or leave it."
"I thought you said it was the best idea we have."
"It is, for Lady Harrowhark. You're the best swordsman that the Ninth House has produced. Maybe ever. Can't say. I never saw Nonius fight."
"Yeah, you would have only been, what, just born?"
said Gideon, whose heart was hurting keenly.
"Shut your mouth or I'll shut it for you."
Swords rattled into a leather case as Iglamine selected a couple at hand, shaking a few of the knuckle knives in to boot. The case creaked, and she creaked as she had to tip herself forward, painful with dignity, getting on her one half-good knee in order to pull herself up to stand. Gideon moved forward automatically, but one look from the woman's working eye was enough to make her pretend she'd just been getting back into her robes. Iglamine hauled the case over her shoulder, kicking unwanted swords back into a niche, yanking the useless sword from Gideon's nerveless hand. She paused as her fingers closed over the hilt, her haggard face caught up in her consideration, a titanic battle apparently going on somewhere deep inside her head. One side gained the upper hand, and she said gruffly,
"Nav, a word of warning."
"What?"
There was something urgent in her voice, something worried, something new.
"Things are changing. I used to think we were waiting for something, and now I think we're just waiting to die."
Gideon's heart sagged. "You really want me to say yes?"
"Go on and say no," said her captain. "It's your choice. If she doesn't take you, I'll go with her, and gladly. But she knows, and I know, and I think you damn well know, that if you don't get out now, you won't even get out in a box."
"So what happens if I agree?"
Breaking the spell, Iglamine roughly shouldered the leather case into Gideon's arms, slapping it there before stalking back the way that Hera had left them.
"Then you hurry up. If I'm to turn you into the Ninth Cavalier, I needed to start 6 years ago."
Chapter 5. The second letter that they received, care of the resurrecting king, the gentle emperor, was somewhat less prolix than the first. They were lurking in the personal Nonagesimus library, a stone-arched room packed tight with shelves of the musty and neglected books Harrowhark didn't study, and the musty, less neglected books that she did. Gideon sat at a broad, sagging desk piled high with pages covered in necromantic marginalia, most of them in Hero's cramped, impatient writing. She held the letter before her with one hand. With the other, she wearily painted her face with a piece of fibre wadding and a pot of alabaster paint, feeling absurdly young. The paint smelled acid and cold, and working the damn stuff into the creases next to her nose meant sucking globs of paint up her nostrils all day. Hero was sprawled on a sofa spread with tattered brocade, robes abandoned, scrawny black-clad legs crossed at the ankles. In Gideon's mind, she looked like an evil stick. Gideon reread the letter, then again, twice, before checking her face in a little cracked mirror. Gorgeous. Hot. "I know you said first house like three times," she said, "but I thought you were being metaphorical."
"I thought it would fill you with a sense of adventure."
"It damn well doesn't," said Gideon, re-wetting the wadding. "You're taking me to the planet where nobody lives. I thought we'd end up on the third or the fifth, or a sweet space station or something, not just another cave filled with old religious nutjobs."
"Why would there be a necromantic gathering on a space station?"
This was a good point. If there was one thing Gideon knew about necromancers, it was that they needed power. Thanagy, death juice, was abundant wherever things had died or were dying. Deep space was a necro's nightmare, because nothing had ever been alive out there, so there were no big puddles of death lying around for Hero and her ilk to suck up with a straw. The brave men and women of the cohort looked on this limitation with compassionate amusement. Never send an adept to do a soldier's job.
"Behold the last paragraph," Hero said from the sofa. "Turning your benighted eyes to lines 5 and 6.
Unwillingly, Gideon turned her benighted eyes to lines 5 and 6.
"Tell me the implications."
Gideon stopped painting and leant back in her chair before thinking better of it, easing it back down to the chill tiles of the floor. There was something a little soggy about one of the legs.
"No retainers, no attendants, no domestics. Well, you'd be shitted all to hell otherwise. You'd have to bring along Crux. Look, are you really saying that nobody's going to be there but us and some crumbly old hierophants?"
"That," said the Reverend Daughter, "is the implication." "For crying out loud, then let me dress how I want and give me back my longsword. 10,000 years of tradition, Griddle."
"I don't have 10,000 years of tradition, bitch," said Gideon. "I have 10 years of two-hander training and a minor allergy to face paint. I'm worth so much less to you with pizza face and a toothpick."
The Reverend Daughter's fingers locked together, thumbs rotating in languid circles. She did not disagree.
10,000 years of tradition, she said slowly, dictates that the ninth house should have been at its leisure to produce, at the very least, a cavalier with the correct sword, the correct training, and the correct attitude. Any implication that the ninth house did not have the leisure to meet even that expectation is as good as giving up. I'd be better off by myself than taking you, Kwa Yu. But I know how to fake this. I can provide the sword. I can provide a smattering of training. I cannot even slightly provide your attitude. 2 out of 3 is still not 3. The con depends on your shut mouth and your adoption of the minimal requirements, Griddle.
So nobody realizes that we're broke and nearly extinct, and that your parents topped themselves.
So nobody takes advantage of the fact that we lack conventional resources, said Hero, shooting Gideon a look that skipped warning and went straight to barrage. So nobody realizes that the house is under threat. So nobody realizes that my parents are no longer able to take care of its interests.
Gideon folded the paper in half again, and made it into corners.
She rubbed it between her fingers for the rare joy of feeling paper crinkle, and then she dropped it on the desk and cleaned paint off her fingernails. She did not need to say or do anything except let the quiet roll out between them.
"We are not becoming an appendix of the third or fifth houses," continued the necromancer opposite. "Do you hear me, Griddle? If you do anything that suggests we're out of order, if I even think you're about to..."
Here, Hero shrugged, quite calmly.
"I'll kill you."
"Naturally. You can't keep this a secret forever."
"When I am a lictor, everything will be different," said Hero Hark. "I'll be in a position to fix things without fear of reprisal. As it is, our leverage now is that nobody knows anything about anything. I've had 3 separate communiques already from other houses asking if I'm coming, and they don't even know my name."
"What the hell are you going to tell them?"
"Nothing, idiot," said Hero. "This is the House of the Ninth, Griddle. We act accordingly."
Gideon checked her face and put down the paint and the wadding. Act accordingly meant that any attempt to talk to an outsider as a kid had led to her getting dragged away bodily. Act accordingly meant the house had been closed to pilgrims for 5 years. Act accordingly had been her secret dread that 10 years from now everyone else would be skeletons and explorers would find Autus reading poetry next to her and Harrow's bodies, their fingers still clasped around each other's throats. Act accordingly, to Gideon, meant being secret and abstruse and super-obsessed with tomes.
"I won't have people asking questions. You'll look the part. Give me that," commanded Hero,
and she took the fat stick of black char from Gideon's hand. She tried to turn Gideon's face up to hers by force, fingers grasping beneath the chin, but Gideon promptly bit her. There was a simple joy in watching Hero swear furiously and shake her hand and peel off the bitten glove, like in seeing sunlight or eating a good meal. Hero began fiddling ominously with one of the bone pins at her ear, so with extreme reluctance, as of an animal not wanting to take medicine, Gideon tilted her face up to get painted. Hero took the black and stroked it beneath Gideon's eyes, none too gently, making her anticipate an exciting jab in the cornea.
"I don't want to dress up like a goddamn nun again. I got enough of that when I was 10, said Gideon.
"Everyone else will be dressing exactly how they ought to dress, said Hera, and if the ninth house contravenes that, the house least likely to do any such thing, then people will examine us a hell of a lot more closely than they ought. If you look just right, then perhaps they won't ask you any tricky questions. They may not discover that the cavalier of the House of the Ninth is an illiterate peon. Hold your mouth closed."
Gideon held her mouth closed, and once Harrow was done, said,
"I object to illiterate."
"Pin-up rags aren't literature, Nav."
"I read them for the articles."
When, as a young and disinclined member of the locked tomb, Gideon had painted her face, she had gone for the bare minimum of death's head that the role demanded. Dark around the eyes, a bit around the nose, a slack black slash across the lips. Now, as Herohark gave her a little palm of cracked mirror, she saw that she was painted like the ancient, tottering necromancers of the house, those ghastly and unsettling sages who never seemed to die, just disappear into the long galleries of books and coffins beneath Dreabur. She'd been slapped up to look like a grim-toothed, black-socketed skull with big black holes on each side of the mandible. Gideon said drearily, "I look like a douche."
"I want you to appear before me every day, like this, until the day we leave," said Hero Hark, and she leant against the desk to view her handiwork. "I won't cut you bald, even though your hair is ridiculous, because I know you won't shave your head daily. Learn this paint. Wear the robe."
"I'm waiting for the end," said Gideon. "You know, the payoff. If you let me have my head, I'd wear my breastplate and use my sword. You're an imbecile if you think I'll be able to fight properly wearing a robe. And I could cavalier until the rest of them went home. I could cavalier until they just made you a hand on the first day and put sexy pictures of me on a calendar. Where's the and, Nona Jessimus?
There is no and, Hera said,
and pushed herself away from Gideon's chair to throw herself back down on the sofa once more.
If it were merely about getting what I wanted, I wouldn't have bothered to take you at all. I would have you packed up in 9 boxes and sent each box to a different house, the 9th box kept for Crux to comfort him in his old age. I will succeed with you in tow, and nobody will ever know that there was aught amiss with the House of the 9th. Paint your face, train with the rapier. You're dismissed.
Isn't this the part where you give me intel? Gideon said, standing up and flexing her stiff muscles. Tell me all you know of the tasks ahead, who we're with, what to expect.
God no, said Hera. All you need to know is that you'll do what I say, or I'll mix bone meal in with your breakfast and punch my way through your gut.
Which was, Gideon had to admit, entirely plausible.
Chapter 6. If Gideon had worried that the next 3 months would see her in close proximity to the Reverend Daughter, she was dead wrong. She spent 6 hours a day learning where to put her feet when she wielded a one-handed sword, where to rest what seemed to her to be her useless, unused arm, how to suddenly make herself a sideways target and always move on the same stupid foot. At the end of each punishing session, Aglamine would take her in a one-on-one fight and disarm her in 3 moves.
Parry, damn you, parry, was the daily refrain. This isn't your long sword, Nav. You block with it again and I'll make you eat it.
On the few early days, when she had foregone the paint, Crux had appeared and turned off the heating to her cell. She would end up slumped on her tier, screaming with cold, numb and nearly dead. So she wore the goddamn paint. It was nearly worse than her pre-cavalier life, except that, as a small mercy, she could train instead of going to prayers, and, as a bigger mercy, Crux and Hera were nearly never around. The heir to the house had ordered her marshal to do something secret down in the bowels of Dreaber, where bowed and creaking 9th brothers and sisters worked hour after hour at whatever grisly task Harrowhark had set. As for the Lady of the 9th herself, she locked herself in the library and didn't come out. Very occasionally, she would watch Gideon train, remark on the absolute lack of progress, make Gideon strip her paint off her face and command her to do it again. One day, she and Aglamine made Gideon walk behind Hera up and down the tiers, shadowing her until Gideon was nearly mad with impatience. The only dubious advantage to this was that she would sometimes hear snatches of conversation, standing motionless and rigid-backed with her hand on the pommel of her sword, and her sightline somewhere beyond Hera's shoulder. Gideon was hungry for intel, but these exchanges were never very illuminating. The most she got was the day Hera, too fretful to modulate her voice, said outright,
"Naturally it's a competition, Captain, even if the wording..."
"Well, the 3rd house will naturally be the best equipped,
and the 2nd will have spent half their lives at the front and be covered in cohort decorations. It doesn't signify. I don't care about soldiers or politicians or priests. It's a greyer house I worry about."
Aglamine said something that Gideon did not catch. Hera gave a short, hard laugh.
"Anyone can learn to fight. Hardly anyone learns to think."
Otherwise, Hera stayed with her books and studied her necromancy, getting leaner and more haggard, crueler and more mean. Each night Gideon fell into bed and was asleep before she could tend her blistered feet and massage her bruised body. On days when she had behaved very well, Aglamine let her train with her longsword instead, which had to pass for fun. The last week before they were due to leave came all at once, like startling awake from a half-remembered and unsettling dream. The Marshal of Dreaber reappeared like a chronic disease to stand over Gideon as she loaded her trunk, all of it with old hand-me-downs of Ortis's that could be hastily remade into three different Gideon-sized articles. These reclaimed robes were like her normal clothes, dour and black, but better made, dourer and blacker. She spent a significant amount of time boring slats into the bottom of the trunk so that she could squirrel away her beloved deserted longsword, packing it like precious contraband. Aglamine had found and reforged the sword of Ortis's grandmother's mother and presented it to a nonplussed Gideon. The blade was black metal, and it had a plain black guard and hilt, unlike the intricate messes of teeth and wires that adorned some of the other rapiers down at the monument. "Oh, this is boring," Gideon had said in disappointment. "I wanted one with a skull puking another smaller skull, and other skulls flying all around. But tasteful, you know." She was also given knuckles. They were even less ornate, being obsidian and steel set in thick and heavy bands. There were three black blades on the back of the gauntlet, rigidly fixed in place. "But for God's sake, don't use them for anything but a parry," said her teacher. "This is confusing. You made me train empty-handed." "Gideon," said her teacher, "after 11 ghoulish weeks of training you, beating you senseless, and watching you fall around like a dropsical infant, you are, on a miraculous day, up to the standard of a bad cavalier, one who's terrible." This was great praise. "But you fall apart as soon as you start to overthink your offhand. Use the knuckles to balance. Give yourself options if someone gets inside your guard, though better yet, don't let them get inside your guard. Keep moving, be fluid. Remember that your hands are now sisters, not twins. One executes your primary action, and the other supports the move. Pray they don't watch you fight too closely. And stop blocking every blow!" On the final day, the entire House of the Ninth filled the tier of the landing field, and they left room to spare. It was sad to watch their eagerness, their kissing Harrowhark's hem over and over. They all knelt in prayer with the god-awful great-aunts as their reverend daughter stood and watched, tranquil and bloodless as the skeletons ploughing in the tiers above. Gideon had noticed the absence of the ex-reverend father and mother, but hadn't thought anything of it. She was too busy thinking about her itchy second-hand clothes and the rapier buckled at her side, and the paint that was now a second skin on her face. But she was still surprised when Hero said, "Brothers and sisters, listen. My mother and father will not be with you. My father has sealed shut the passageway to the tomb that must always be locked, and they have decided to continue their penitence behind that wall until I return. The marshal will act as seneschal for me, and my captain will act as marshal." Testament to Hero's timing for drama, the secondarius bell began ringing. From above the drill shaft, the shuttle started to make its descent, blotting out the ever-fainter light of the equinox. For the very first time, Gideon did not feel the overwhelming sense of dread and suspicion. A pinprick of anticipation curled in her gut instead. "Round two. Go." Harrowhark looked out at the people of the Ninth. So did Gideon. There were all the assorted nuns and brethren, old pilgrims and aging vassals, every gloomy, severe and stern face of adept and mystic, of joyless and wasted men and women, of the grey and monotonous population that had made up Gideon's life and never shown her one single moment of sympathy or kindness. Hera's face was bright with elation and fervour. Gideon would have sworn there were tears in her eyes, except that no such liquid existed.
Hero was a desiccated mummy of hate.
"You are my beloved house," she said. "Rest assured that wherever I go, my heart is interred here."
It sounded like she really meant it.
Hero began,
"We pray the tomb is shut forever."
And Gideon found herself reciting, simply because it was the only prayer she'd ever known, enduring the words by saying them as sounds without meaning. She stopped when Herohark stopped, her hands clasped, and added,
"I pray for our success for the house. I pray for the lictors, devoted hands of the Emperor. I pray to be found pleasing in his eyes. I pray for the cavalier."
At this, Gideon caught the dark, black-rimmed eye and could imagine the mental accompaniment.
"To choke to death on her own vomit."
"Let it be so," said the Lady of the Ninth House. The rattling of the assorted prayer bones very nearly drowned out the clank of the shuttle, docking. Gideon turned away, not meaning to make any kind of goodbye, but she saw Iglamine, hand crooked into a stiff salute, and realized for the first time that she might never see the woman again. God help her, she might never come back. For a moment, everything seemed dizzyingly unsure. The house continued on in grand and grisly majesty because you were always looking at it. It continued because you watched it continue, changeless and black before your eyes. The idea of leaving it made it seem so fragile as to crumble the moment they turned their backs. Herohark turned toward the shuttle, and Gideon realized with an unwelcome jolt that she was crying. Her paint was wet with tears. And then the whole idea became beautiful. The moment Gideon turned her back on it, the house would die. The moment Gideon walked away, it would all disappear like an impossibly bad dream. She mentally staved in the sides of the enormous shadowy cave and buried Dribber in rock, and for good measure, exploded Crux like a garbage bag full of soup. But she saluted Iglamine as crisply and as enthusiastically as a soldier on her first day of service, and was pleased when her teacher rolled her eyes. As they pulled themselves into the shuttle, the door mechanism sliding down with a pleasingly final whunk, she leaned into Hero. Hero, who was dabbing her eyes with enormous gravity. The necromancer flinched outright. "Do you want," Gideon whispered huskily, "my hanky?"
"I want to watch you die."
"Maybe, Nona Jessimus," she said with deep satisfaction. "Maybe, but you sure as hell won't do it here."
Chapter 7. From space, the house of the first shone like fire on water. Wreathed in the white smoke of its atmosphere, blue like the heart of a gas-ignited flame, it burned the eye. It was absolutely lousy with water, smothering it all in the bluest of blue conflagrations. Visible even up here were the floating chains of squares and rectangles and oblongs, smudging the blue with grey and green, brown and black. The tumbled-down cities and temples of a house both long dead and unkillable. A sleeping throne. Far away, its king and emperor sat on his seat of office and waited, a sentinel protecting his home but never able to return to it. The lord of the House of the First was the Lord Undying, and he had not come back in over 9,000 years. Gideon Nav pressed her face up to the plexiform window of the shuttle and looked as if she couldn't ever get enough of looking, until her eyes were red and streaming and huge migraine motes danced along the edge of her vision. All the other shutters were closed up tight, and had been for most of the trip, which had taken about an hour of rapid travel.
They had been surprised to find that behind the Plex privacy barrier, Hero Hark had coolly slid up the moment they were inside, there was no pilot on board. The ship was being remotely piloted at great expense. There was no clearance for anybody to land at the first house without explicit invitation. There was a button to press if you needed to talk to the remote navigator, and Gideon had been eager to hear another voice. But Hero had slid the barrier back down with an air of distinct finality. She looked worn and exhausted, even vulnerable. For the journey's length, she had kept her prayer knuckles in her hands and moodily clinked them into each other. In Gideon's comics, cohort adepts always sat on plackets of grave dirt to ameliorate the effects of deep space and the loss of their power source. Trust Hero Hark not to take the placebo. Gideon had warmed herself with the thought that it was the perfect time to kick her ass up and down the shuttle, but in the end, the natural embarrassment of arriving with one's necromancer's elbows on backwards saved Hero's life. All thoughts of ass-kicking had subsided as the approach of the first house reflected light through the open window, light that spilled into the passenger bay in fiery gouts. Gideon had to turn her face away, half blind and breathless. Hero was tying a piece of black voile around her eyes, as calm and uninterested as if what hung outside the window was dreary ninth sky. Gideon cupped her hands over her eyes to shade them and looked again, getting her fill of the explosive brilliance outside. The velvety blackness of space with innumerable pinprick white stars. The first, a searing circle of incandescent blue strewn with dazzling white, and the outsides of seven more shuttles lining up in orbit. Gideon gave a low whistle to see them. To an inhabitant of the sepulchrous ninth house, it seemed amazing that the whole thing didn't just combust and crumble into flame. There were other houses that made their homelands on planets closer to the burning star of Domenicus, the seventh and the sixth, for instance. But to Gideon, they could not imaginably be anything else than 100% on fire. It was incredible. It was exquisite. She wanted to throw up.